This is
okay.
House and Senate Judiciary Committees will meet jointly. I'm opening the House Committee.
And I'm opening up the Senate Judiciary Committee for this presentation.
Thank you. And the first item on the agenda is understanding tribal law. I want to recognize the people here today. I want to thank everybody that's here today. And also there's a overflow seating in the next room over, if there are too many people. I want to thank everybody for being here, especially our special guest members of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services. Could you please rise or raise your hands while I read out your names? We understand your LCIS Chair, Dan Courtney, and a few additional members had other commitments and can't be with us this afternoon. In addition to Dan Courtney, Cow Creek Chair, the LCIS members are Leo Stewart, LCIS Vice Chair and Vice Chair of the Umatilla Band of Trustees, Bob Garcia, Confederated Tribes of Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Chair, Brenda Mead, Coquille Indian Tribe Chair, Cheryl Kennedy, Grand Ronde Council, Raymond Sumpty, Warm Springs Council, Dee Pigsley, Silas Tribal Chair, Don Gentry, Klamath Tribal Chair, Burns Paiute just had tribal elections and their members did not seek re-election, so there will be a new LCIS rep soon. In addition to the LCIS legislators are Senator Ted Ferrioli and our fellow Senate Judiciary Committee member Arnie Roblin, Representative Greg Smith, Representative Caddy McEwen. We also have one non-voting LCIS member, Jackie Mercer, CEO of Native American Rehab Association Northwest. There may be other tribal leaders, tribal members, and tribal staff here, including Bonnie McCaffrey, Cow Creek Board member, sitting in for Dan Courtney. Welcome. The first portion of our informational hearing is on tribal sovereignty, what it means, and how we might need to think about this as legislators. We're pleased to have a distinguished panel of four speakers for this 90-minute presentation. First, we will hear from Jason Yonker, Coquille Indian Tribal member, but here today in his capacity as Tribal Advisor on Sovereignty and Government-to-Government at the University of Oregon. Next will be Ted Simmons, who has worked for 20 years in the U.S. Attorney's Office, followed by Craig Dorsey of Dorsey and Easton LLP, a national expert on the Indian Child Welfare Act. Our last speaker will be Pete Shepard of Farang Long and Gary Rudrick, PC, former Deputy State Attorney General, who will touch on how tribal sovereignty and state law and policy intersect. We hope this afternoon's presentation is part of an ongoing conversation with our tribal partners and one additional opportunity to learn more in a strengthened government-to-government relationship between the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon has 9 federally recognized tribal governments in Oregon. If we could have our first speaker up, and please, as you introduce yourself, please give your name and identify yourself for the record. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Yonker. I'm a member of the Coquille Indian Tribe from Coos Bay, where I've lived my entire life. In fact, my family's lived there for about 10,000 years, and we still live there. But I'm here in my capacity as Assistant Vice President and Advisor to the President for Sovereignty and Government-to-Government Relations at the University of Oregon. This is a new position. I'm the eyes and ears of Interim President Scott Coltrane, and we are working together with the tribes to strengthen that relationship. I am the President's Tribal Liaison to the 9 federally recognized tribes, but also to the 41 external tribes with Aboriginal ties to the state of Oregon. My responsibilities at the university are to strengthen the relationship between the President of the university and the 9 chairs of Oregon's federally recognized Indian tribes. To do so effectively, the university must first understand the historical foundation upon which sovereignty was built, how the tribes perceive sovereignty, and to build a platform of trust based upon our mutual understanding of sovereignty. In Oregon, and because of the various tribal histories, whether they are a restored tribe or a treaty tribe, sovereignty may be interpreted in different ways. I am not here to provide you with the exact perceptions and interpretations of sovereignty among each of the unique tribes, but to give you an overview on how this applies to the state. You're receiving my abridged version for the time allotted. There are dissertations about this stuff. I have reserved time at the end for questions. For the last 10 years, I've worked in the state of New York and have had a privilege of working with the Haudenosaunee Nations, which is also known as the Iroquois Confederacy. The Haudenosaunee Nations, or the Iroquois Confederacy in New York State, are one of the world's oldest and greatest examples of democracy. When they first encountered Europeans, their meeting was memorialized with the two-row wampum belt, a belt with two horizontal lines indicating side-by-side cooperation but non-intersecting self-governance. This was the first agreement between Europeans and American Indian nations, and the very basis for virtually all sovereign nation agreements, both foreign and domestic. Benjamin Franklin consistently promoted the Iroquois Confederacy as a model for the 13 colonies, and ultimately, the Haudenosaunee's democracy was a template for the U.S. Constitution. And by the way, today is Constitution Day. Each federally recognized tribe in Oregon signed treaties with the federal government. Not all treaties were ratified by Congress. Each of the tribes gave up their homelands for promises based on a mutual trust, what is broadly known as the government's trust doctrine. The purpose behind the trust doctrine is and has always been to ensure the survival and welfare of Indian tribes and people. This includes an obligation to provide services to protect and enhance Indian lands, resources, and self-government, and also includes economic and social programs which are necessary to raise the standard of living and social well-being of the Indian people to a level comparable to the non-Indian society. Only Congress can terminate a trust responsibility. Each tribe, and there are 566 tribes nationwide, has a unique trust relationship with the federal government based upon the trust established through the process of federal recognition. As a rule, tribes are wards of the federal government. We are dependent sovereigns who can self-govern with the protection of sovereign status on our lands. In most cases, states do not have the right to enforce state laws on reservation or trust properties. As a general rule, states cannot regulate the activities of reservation Indians without the express consent of Congress. Congress can also give rights to Indians without the state's consent. This is not to say that the state of Oregon has no jurisdiction, and we can expressly note Public Law 280, which gave limited jurisdiction to apply criminal laws on reservations, among other things. This excludes the Warm Springs Reservation. A state law that is inconsistent with federal law violates the federal trust responsibilities and our sovereignty. As sovereign nations, on the reservations we have the right to tax. We have the right to maintain law and order. We have the right to regulate commerce and trade. We have the right to engage commerce and trade. We have the right to exercise civil jurisdiction. Only rarely has Congress expressly authorized a state to extend its civil powers into Indian country. The U.S. Constitution expressly requires each state to give full faith and credit to the laws and court decisions of another state. Indians must pay federal income taxes unless a treaty or statute gives them an exemption. The Indian Tribal Government Tax Status Act of 88 provides Indian tribes with the same basic exemptions from federal taxation that states enjoy. Reservation Indians do not have to pay state income taxes on money they earn on the reservation. When Indians are off the reservation, they are fully subject to state taxation unless a federal treaty or law confers an immunity. A state cannot refuse to provide services to reservation Indians based on the grounds that they are exempt from state taxation. We are domestic sovereign nations with rights of self-governance afforded and protected by the U.S. federal government. These are not to be confused with the full sovereignty enjoyed by foreign nations. We are the only domestic ethnic group required to prove our affiliation with a federally issued enrollment card. Congress, and not the executive branch, has the ultimate authority with regard to matters affecting Indian tribes. Federal courts give greater deference to Congress on Indian matters than on any other subject. The federal government has a duty to protect the tribes, which implies that the courts, as the courts have found, the necessary legislative and executive authorities to effect that duty. Every tribal nation has the inherent right to self-govern. We are entitled to equal protection of the laws. We understand our sovereignty to be under federal jurisdiction. We are each unique governments with elected and appointed officials. We see our relationship with states to be separate in hope that they become complementary. We gave up our lands for the promise that true sovereignty remain protected. We do not operate with indifference to our state, but with keen understanding of what we have lost over time and at what cost. The tribes or states' ability or inability to work with other governments is only limited by the lack of imagination or indifference to the polities around us. We must, both states and tribal nations, find ways to strengthen our respective communities by using the advantages sovereignty affords tribal nations. Tribes are culturally bound to reciprocity, and relationships built on this foundation will mutually flourish. Sovereignty for the tribes will always be protected at all cost and is guaranteed by our federal trustee. Thank you. And with permission, the remainder of time be allotted for questions.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Not a question.
I just want to make a statement. Jason's family is a really big part of our community. His mom and dad were both teachers. And his mom was probably one of the best math teachers I've ever known. So I have always appreciated the family. And they continue to be a major part of our whole community. And it was really great to have Jason back in the state of Oregon. Instead of Oregon.
I made a donation earlier.
Thank you. That was great. Thank you very much.
Mr. Simmons?
He's got the system figured out.
Wow.
Good afternoon, Chairman, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. My name is Tim Simmons, and I serve as an Assistant United States Attorney. And as indicated, I think in my brief introduction, is I've been with the U.S. Attorney's Office for about 20 years now. I carry a criminal caseload, a civil caseload, and I'm also one of the tribal liaisons in the District of Oregon for the U.S. Attorney's Office. I'm here today to actually discuss tribal sovereignty and specifically how it intersects with the federal government. And I was asked to provide a general brief discussion of some of the aspects of tribal sovereignty that impact the federal government and specifically some of my work in Indian country that I deal with. As kind of the previous speaker did, I'll provide this speech with kind of two caveats. One of them is due to the time constraints, I'm going to talk in broadly general terms, as indicated before, the type of issues that were discussed with tribal sovereignty and federal government issues could take days and days, if not weeks. So I'm going to do some broad terms and general discussions. The important subject of tribal sovereignty and the interaction of the United States obviously covers hundreds of years and involves complicated legal concepts which requires in-depth analysis, and I will highlight at least some of the important issues that impact my work with the tribal governments and tribal sovereignty. An additional caveat I'll provide is that the United States policies towards tribes and Native Americans have varied greatly over the years. Discussions regarding the United States policies toward tribal governments typically divide approaches into five distinct time periods. For the purpose of this conversation, I think it is important to have a general understanding and application of the varying government policies applied to the tribal nations over the years. And I think it's important as you look at government policy, especially from a federal government perspective, how these different time policies and periods have impacted our policy and approach today. So briefly, I'm just going to run through some of those time periods or issues. A policy and time period spanning from about 1828 to 1881 is often referred to as the relocation time period. This consists of the removal of the Eastern Indian tribes to the West. In 1830, as part of this policy, Congress passed the Indian Removal Act, which was authorized the president to negotiate with Eastern tribes for the relocation west of the Mississippi River. Between 1832 and 1843, most Eastern tribes were removed to the west or placed on smaller reservations in the east. The next policy and time period spanned from about 1887 to 1934 and is often referred to as allotment or assimilation. This consisted of a policy and an attempt to assimilate tribes and tribal members into non-Indian society. In 1887, Congress passed the General Allotment Act, and the objectives of the act were to extinguish tribal sovereignty, dissolve reservations, and force the assimilation of Indians into society at large. The act authorized the president to divide tribal lands into separate tribal member parcels, allotments, with the remaining tribal land being sold to non-Indian farmers and ranchers. From about 1934 to 1953, we entered a policy and time often referred to as Indian Reorganization. In 1934, Congress passed the Indian Reorganization Act. It sought to reestablish tribal governments by prohibiting further allotment of tribal land to tribal members, encouraging tribal self-government, and the adoption of tribal constitution. From about 1953 to 1968, the United States adopted a policy often referred to as termination. This consisted of an attempt to terminate the federal government's trust relationship with tribes and the elimination of federal benefits and support services to tribes. During this time period, Congress terminated the trust relationship with 109 tribes between 1953 and 1966. The tribes were ordered to cease exercising governmental powers and to disperse all land and property to tribal members for those particular tribes. The tribe's reservation was then eliminated, and the state acquired full jurisdiction over this land and the people who resided there. As part of this policy, Congress passed Public Law 280 in 1953, which gave six states, including Oregon, some limited criminal jurisdiction over Indian reservations. From 1968 to the present, we enter policy and time often referred to as tribal self-determination. In 1968, Congress prohibited the states from acquiring any additional authority over Indian reservations under Public Law 280 without the consent of the tribe, and Congress restored to federal status nearly all the tribes terminated during the termination era. I started in the Department of Justice in 1995, so my entire time with Department of Justice has been within this policy, the tribal self-determination. And my comments regarding tribal sovereignty and the federal government are shaped based upon that tribal self-determination policy. I provided, though, to this committee because those years, hundreds of years prior to tribal self-determination, have shaped the interaction between tribes and the federal government. And I think it's important to understand that concept coming in, because many people in this room went through some of those policies and times, and I think they bring that to the conversation that we take place. With those caveats in mind, I would like to discuss two main concepts which guide my work with tribal government and tribal sovereignty. Those two concepts are trust responsibility and consultation. I'm going to try to not overlap with the comments that were previously made, but from a federal government perspective, an important aspect of tribal sovereignty and my interactions and the government interactions with the tribal government in the United States is the federal trust responsibility. The federal trust responsibility, an established legal obligation based on the unique historical relationship between the United States and tribes, and as indicated, dating back as early as 1831, the United States formally recognized the existence of the federal trust responsibility toward tribes. For more than four decades, nearly every administration has recognized the trust responsibility and the unique government-to-government relationship between the United States and the tribes. The trust responsibility originates from a variety of sources, including the United States Constitution, treaties, statutes, executive orders, and other federal laws. The United States Constitution recognized Indian tribes as entities distinct from states and foreign nations. In addition, the United States entered into nearly 400 treaties with Indian tribes between 1787 and 1871. In those treaties, the United States was able to avoid further war and obtain land from the tribes, and in exchange, the federal government reserved parcels of land for these tribes and guaranteed certain rights and services. Treaties vary, and the folks in this room have different treaties that impact them, but nearly all of them express and recognize the sovereignty of the tribes and may contain express assurances that the federal government would create a federally protected reservation for the tribe and to provide for the well-being of tribal members. Congress ended treaty making with Indian lands in 1871, and after 1871, Congress has regulated Indian affairs through federal statutes. These statutes create programs and services for Indians and tribes which attempt to address the treaty promises and commitments made, and at least for my involvement, an entire code of the U.S. Code, Title 25, covers dealing with Indians and tribal issues. I also deal with some codes specific to criminal jurisdiction in Indian country under 18 U.S.C. In regards to the federal government and Department of Justice, several presidents have issued executive orders regarding tribal sovereignty. In 1994, President Clinton issued an executive order that requires all federal agencies to conduct business with Indian tribes on a government-to-government basis, respectful of tribal sovereignty. In 2000, President Clinton issued an executive order that reaffirms the right of Indian tribes to self-government and that requires federal agencies to work to protect tribal trust resources and Indian tribal treaty and other rights. In 2009, President Obama reaffirmed these executive orders and also issued an executive order requiring federal agencies to engage in meaningful consultation with tribal governments prior to taking any action that may impact the tribe's interest. In general, the trust responsibility establishes a variety of duties and responsibilities upon the United States and the federal agencies. It has been interpreted as requiring the federal government to support and encourage tribal self-government, and the duty to protect and provide assistance regarding guarantees and rights, especially set forth in federal treaties. In addition, the United States must meet to ensure the protection of tribal lands, assets, resources, and treaty and similar recognized rights. The trust responsibility guides the work of the U.S. Attorney's Office in both the prosecution of crime in Indian country as well as representation of federal agencies in the civil context. Briefly, a critical part of their trust responsibility is also consultation with tribal governments. The tribal consultation, at least for the Department of Justice, has been reconfirmed through several executive orders, and the Department of Justice is committed to regular and meaningful consultation and working with tribal officials. In regards to tribal consultation, based upon those policies, we essentially go by four guiding principles for all tribal consultations conducted by the Department of Justice. One, consultation will involve timely, adequate notice to the appropriate parties. Consultation will be accessible and convenient to tribal participants. Consultation will be a meaningful process involving appropriate participants and involve the meaningful and transparent account of that process that is used. In that regard, just briefly on the work examples in regards to at least my work with the U.S. Attorney's Office, tribal sovereignty guides and has a direct impact on both the criminal and civil work relevant to Indian Country. In regards to criminal work, the U.S. Attorney's Office prosecute crimes related to Indian Country. The term Indian Country is specifically defined by federal criminal statute and generally covers all land under the supervision of the U.S. government that has been set aside primarily for the use of Indians. That includes all land within an Indian reservation and all land outside a reservation that has been placed under federal superintendence and designated primarily for Indian use. As indicated by the previous speaker, though, we did have Public Law 280, which impacts six of the nine tribes here in the state of Oregon. It was mentioned that Warm Springs Tribe was exempted from Public Law 280. I also mentioned that there was also retrocession regarding Umatilla and Burns Paiute Tribe. So in regards to the general criminal prosecution and jurisdiction, we still deal with those issues on Warm Springs Tribe, Umatilla Tribe, and Burns Paiute Tribe, and the other six tribes is covered by Public Law 280. In regards to civil work, I also end up representing federal agencies in a variety of matters which impacts tribal sovereignty and the rights of tribal governments. A typical example would be representing the Department of Interior in an action agency has taken regarding Indian Country. In addition, I work with tribal governments to resolve potential issues of conflict with federal agencies regarding issues concerning trust responsibility or trust land. At this time, I'd be glad to address if there's any specific questions or issues that any of the committee members would like me to specifically address.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Before I call the next speaker, I want to take a moment to introduce a new member to the committee, Danae Bowles.
Thanks.
Sitting down here is replaced Representative Kevin Cameron, who's now a county commissioner, and she's finishing up the rest of his term this year. So welcome. Craig Dorsey, please.
Yes. Thank you. I have some materials I'd like handed out.
Okay, great. Okay, I'm going to take it from the general to the specific more and talk about Indian children, and specifically the Indian Child Welfare Act. I'll talk a very tiny bit about Oregon. I don't know if you're going to hand out the materials or so now. That would
be
useful.
He will.
Okay. So one of the things, there's three things I'm handing out. The first is a one page from a federal report. It's the most recent report on out-of-home placement statistics for children. And the page I'm giving you is from Oregon for 2012. And if you look at the areas I've highlighted, you'll notice that the out-of-home placement rates for Indian children still have a disparity rate of 3.5 times their population. So in other words, 3.5 times more Indian children are being removed from their homes than are represented by the Oregon population. Now, the Indian Child Welfare Act, which was passed in 1978, it was based on findings and a report done in the late 1960s where Congress found that there were these disparate removal rates for Indian children, and the whole purpose of the act was intended to reduce those disparate placements. As these statistics reveal, we still have a long ways to go 35 years after placement of the act. The second set of materials is the PowerPoint. I only had a couple days to get this together. It's mostly related, I'll talk about it, principles of authority. over Indian children, both state and tribal, just general principles. Because the whole idea of the Indian Child Welfare Act is to improve outcomes for Indian children. And when it's applied correctly, it's done that, and states and tribes work together to do that. It works well. But when it doesn't work, we still have a long ways to go on that. The third set of materials is a set I just finished for the National Council on Juvenile and Family Court Judges. I've done a variety of publications for them. This is like a bench book. It's just highlights of the Indian Child Welfare Act, because we won't have a chance to get to those today in any detail. And it's issues that come up, the state court juvenile judges have emphasized over and over again. These issues have come up. They have to react in a short period of time. They sometimes have a misunderstanding or misassumption about something basic, and this gives them quick guidance while they're sitting on the bench about essential points of the Indian Child Welfare Act. I started practicing in 1979. I graduated from Oregon Law School. I went to work for the Native American Program of Oregon Legal Services, which had just been started. My first case was an Indian Child Welfare Act case. The law had just become effective. Because I didn't have any other cases at that time, I was able to read the legislative history of the act, and I sort of became the instant national expert. And I've been doing it ever since. In 1982, I went down to work for the Navajo Nation Department of Justice, doing their Indian Child Welfare Act caseload. They had 500 or more cases going at any one time all across the country. I would go out and ride circuit for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, going from state to state where there were Navajo cases. My last estimate is I've appeared in 32 different state courts on Indian Child Welfare Act cases. I also consult with the American Bar Association Center for Children and the Law, where we advise different states on their implementation of the act and help with their state codes and their agency implementation of the act. And I think I've been to 16 states in the last 8 years or so. So it's a fairly broad range of experience. Now, just coming back to Oregon, I want to just start out with the Oregon Territorial Act. This is my little bit of history. Expressly disclaims any authority by the Territory of Oregon over Indian lands. So that's in the Territorial Act, and that provision was expressly incorporated in the Oregon Constitution. So we start with this perspective of Indian lands are not part of the state of Oregon in full. In fact, there is a case, an Oregon appellate case just a couple years ago in 1996 talking about Warm Springs, and the court ruled, although the Warm Springs Reservation is located within the exterior boundaries of Oregon, tribal members living on the reservation do not reside in Oregon. The Warm Springs tribes are a distinct community. Although theirs is within the exterior boundaries of Oregon, it is not fully part of the state. The tribes occupy their own territory within particular boundaries in which the laws of Oregon have no force and into which the citizens of Oregon have no right to enter. So this is the basic presumption that we start with, and in the field of domestic relations, it means that Indian tribes have exclusive authority over Indian children who live on the reservations. The problem we encounter is that there are very few what I would call pure Indian families now, where both the father and the mother are tribal members of the same tribe, and where they've lived their whole life on the reservation. In many cases, or in most cases, you have a non-Indian father, an Indian mother, you have some children who are tribal members, you may have others if there's been remarriages who aren't tribal members. They've lived part of their life off reservation, they live part of their life on reservation. They have all kinds of different events that have taken place on and off. And trying to figure out who has authority and who can best help the children is extremely difficult. So this was talked about in the previous presentation. I'm not going to go over it too much. It just talks about how tribes are not part of the state. So in the, this is a gaming case from 1996, the U.S. Supreme Court confirmed that states as a constitutional matter under the U.S. Constitution have been divested of virtually all authority over Indian commerce and Indian tribes. And then Tim and Jason both talked about Public Law 280, which gave partial jurisdiction to the state. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled, as Jason and Tim talked about, that Indian tribes gave up some parts of their inherent sovereignty when the United States was formed, their domestic dependent relations. And in particular, the United States Supreme Court has ruled that as a general matter, Indian tribes don't have authority over non-Indians, non-members. So when you have a non-Indian living on the reservation and a blended family, this can raise some serious issues. The Supreme Court has also ruled that one of the inherent aspects, basic aspects of tribes that they retain, even with their more limited status, is authority over domestic relations. So you have this intersection of two issues. In the Fisher versus District Court opinion, a Supreme Court opinion, the United States Supreme Court held that two Indians living on a reservation who wanted to adopt another tribal member child were prohibited from going into state court to complete that adoption because allowing that action would undermine tribal sovereignty and the authority of tribal courts. As long as the father and the mother remained domiciled and residing on the reservation, the only place they could prosecute their adoption was in the tribal court. And the Supreme Court held that that conclusion that they reached was part of the federal policy to support and enhance tribal sovereignty and tribal self-government. When you have families who live both on and off reservation, what you end up with is the state and the tribe sharing jurisdiction over Indian children and what I'll call Indian families. So in a lot of cases, and there's cases from all over the United States, it's a matter of which government exercises authority first. So we have a lot of divorce actions, for example, where you have the Indian spouse goes into tribal court to file divorce, the non-Indian spouse goes into state court to obtain a divorce, and in most of those cases, who has jurisdiction depends on where you went first. Then you get child custody as part of domestic relations or a divorce action or a juvenile action, and the matter can get even more complicated because even though a state court might have jurisdiction over a divorce, say the non-Indian father lives in Portland, if the children have remained on the Warm Springs Reservation, under the principles I just discussed, the state has no authority over those children, so the state court lacks authority to grant custody of them to either parent. So you can end up with situations where you have one court cannot effect a complete settlement of a divorce case. The Montana case in this slide is the one that announced that as a general rule, tribes have lost their authority over non-member Indians. There's a number of exceptions to that principle, though. One is if a non-member consents to tribal jurisdiction. So, and this is not in the domestic relations context, but you'll note that about every time you enter a tribal casino, you'll most often run into a sign at the entrance to the casino that says, by entering here, you have expressly consented to tribal jurisdiction for any matter arising out of your presence here. Those signs are there as a result of this exception to the Montana decision that allows tribes to continue to assert authority. The Indian Child Welfare Act is an express federal statute that allows, one, confirms inherent tribal sovereignty because it confirms that tribes retain exclusive jurisdiction over their own members on their own reservations. But it's also an affirmative grant of jurisdiction because when I said tribes have lost authority over non-Indians, the definition of non-Indian that the Supreme Court uses also includes non-member Indians. In other words, an Indian from another tribe who goes, let's say a Siletz Indian goes to the Warm Springs Reservation, as a general rule, the Warm Springs tribe doesn't have authority over the Siletz Indian either. However, the Indian Child Welfare Act expressly states Indian tribes have exclusive jurisdiction over any Indian child, whatever tribe they're from, who resides or is domiciled on a reservation. So it gives tribes broader jurisdiction. In the slides, and I'm not going to go over these are some of the situations that rise up, is whether the tribe loses authority when you have a blended family, whether a non-Indian consents to tribal authority by moving on to the reservation. And then we have a variety of case law, which I just leave you to read at your own. We have an Alaska case that just came out a month ago, which affirmed the authority of one Alaska village to terminate the parental rights to a father from another Alaska village and decide custody. South Dakota is not the most cooperative state on the Indian Child Welfare Act. There's a federal civil rights suit going on right now, brought by the United States as trustee for the tribes to force the state to comply with the Indian Child Welfare Act because they're not doing so. In this case, the state of South Dakota refused to give full faith and credit, and that's another element of the Indian Child Welfare Act. It requires states for the first time to give full faith and credit to tribal court orders involving Indian children, the same as the state of Oregon would have to give full faith and credit to other state court orders. We have marriage of Skillen from Montana, where the Montana Supreme Court affirmed the authority over a non-Indian father who had never resided on the reservation to decide the custody of his children. We have one Oregon case I just want to cite, and that's the state XRL CSD versus Klamath tribes. So one way is to handle the Indian Child Welfare Act and these jurisdictional questions is you can enter into an agreement, an intergovernmental agreement. And ORS 190.110 allows any agency in Oregon to enter into agreements with Indian tribes. And that includes under the Indian Child Welfare Act. Well, the state entered into an agreement with the Klamath tribe, and part of that included not only Indian children as defined by the act, but also descendants of tribal members. And the Oregon Court of Appeals ruled that that agreement had gone too far, that the state could only enter into agreements for Indian children as defined by the act. Quickly, one other area where there's a severe problem is in the area of services for children who are in the foster care system. So Indian tribes don't have a lot of money. They don't get a lot of money from the federal government. Title IV-E provides most of the foster care payments here. Some tribes contract with the state of Oregon to run foster care, Title IV-E, but they have to follow state rules. A new federal law 3 years ago allows tribes to contract directly for those funds for the first time. But the technical requirements of complying with that are very difficult. Essentially, you have to have like an information sharing system that's the equivalent of the state of Oregon's for a small tribe. So no tribes in Oregon have done that yet. Title IV-E doesn't pay for services to the family. When an Indian tribe takes jurisdiction over a child, the state no longer has a legal obligation to pay for services for the child. So one of the areas that where there's been a lot of difficulty is tribes haven't been able to take jurisdiction over children they'd like to, because once the children are back on the reservation, the tribe may not be able to afford the services to those children. Now, the Siletz Tribe's 4E agreement provides for the state to continue some of those services even after jurisdiction has been transferred. So that way, the tribe and the state can determine which jurisdiction is best equipped to handle the family, provide services, deal with the children in that case. I think I've gone over my time. One thing I just want to mention real quickly, so a couple issues have come up recently. In Indian Child Welfare Act cases, a lot of tribes are from out of state. They have children in the state of Oregon, come within the system. The Indian Child Welfare Act gives tribes the right to intervene and be a party in every case involving their children. The problem is, if you have an out-of-state tribe to come into the state of Oregon, you have to hire a local lawyer because you're out-of-state and get admitted pro hac vice. So you have to go to the expense of hiring a local lawyer. You have to pay fees for the appearance of that lawyer. Not all tribes are rich with gaming. It's a significant expense for some tribes to be able to appear. And I know our office has been contacted by a number of tribes who've wanted to appear in the state of Oregon and retain us but don't have the funds to do so. And that undermines the whole purpose of the Indian Child Welfare Act. So with that, I'll stop. If you have any questions, I'm glad to answer.
Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
So if we can just follow up on that last comment, has that been challenged in any states?
It hasn't. We've been talking about, I'm president of the Indian Law Section this year. We've been talking about trying to perhaps get a rule that would allow the exemption, but it's been opposed by other parts, committees in the bar, because obviously the fees, for example, go for indigent defense. We do have one case from Oregon, though, that says the Indian Child Welfare Act says the tribe can intervene, so it doesn't technically require a lawyer. The social worker can participate. The problem is when you're arguing then legal issues in a court proceeding, the social worker is at a disadvantage going up against a state attorney or appointed attorney for the parents.
Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Follow-up, please.
So I guess the second part of that question is there any guidance from any other states that shows a model that could be used?
Yes, several states allow that to happen. Minnesota, I think, and Wisconsin do.
Can you provide that to us?
Yes, I'd be glad to.
And I have a question on the children, the disproportionate amount of children being taken out of the home. Do those children end up back usually with Indian homes? No.
Okay. Not as a general rule. There's still an extreme shortage of qualified foster homes, tribal foster homes. That's part of why, you know, in the Indian Child Welfare Act, a lot of what happens is when the case first arises in state court, the tribe appears to monitor it and assist, but they want the family to get back together. Then when the decision is made that the child can't go back home, then the tribe would like to get the case transferred because they're best suited to do placement with a tribal home.
Right.
And there's some problems with that. But there's an extreme shortage in recruitment and numbers of foster homes.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mr. Shepherd.
Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the Joint Committee. I'm Pete Shepherd. I represent the Confederated Tribes of the Coos, Loramqua, and Sausla Indians. When Mr. Taylor initially asked me to participate in today's proceedings, I tried to figure out why. There are many lawyers, including several of you here in the audience today, who are far more expert in Indian law and in the issues that I've been asked to address than I am. There are lots of professionals, some non-lawyer professionals, who work for tribes in Oregon who have more expertise. For example, Mr. Zimmerman of the Umatilla Tribe have more expertise than I do in tax issues and the intersection with Indian law. And finally, of course, I'm not a member of a tribe, and I can't speak to sovereignty with the conviction of a person who has experienced the searing denial of a tribe's existence in the form of the termination policy adopted by this nation in the 1950s, or the exultant feeling that tribal members surely must have felt when Congress successively restored recognition to those tribes. And so on all those counts, I'm not well qualified to speak to these, best qualified to speak to these issues. Because I'm unwilling to ascribe to Mr. Taylor any irrational thought, I concluded that perhaps the reason that he asked me to do this is that, like many of you, most of my experience is in advising governments that are not tribal governments. And perhaps the fact that I'm about 3 years into the experience of learning what Indian country looks like from the other side of the telescopic lens, maybe there's something about that experience that I can help share with you today that might be useful to you as you work on the specific issues you've heard about today and that I'm going to talk about. So before I turn to the three topics that I've been substantive topics I've been assigned, I thought I would just offer up four lessons that I think I've learned so far, and I must say I'm a long ways from learning all the lessons that the tribes and my client have to teach me about sovereignty specifically. And the first one I want to share with you involves my tenure at the Department of Justice under Hardy Myers. He took very seriously the government-to-government relationship between the state government and tribes, and indeed throughout his 12 years and my 8 years as deputy, there in the front office of the Department of Justice, we had the service of a wonderfully talented tribal liaison lawyer named Stephanie Striffler. And each time we had a group of new lawyers and new employees join the department, we did a new employee orientation, and Stephanie typically would give a presentation on tribal sovereignty to those new employees. And when Stephanie was not available, it fell to me to do that, much as Mr. Taylor may have fallen, it may have fallen to me by default by Mr. Taylor for today's appearance. And so I took up that occasion, and I was patting myself on the back after one of those presentations because I had made a point of boiling down sovereignty into what I thought was a brilliant small metaphor, and it was simply that one way for folks to think about it who aren't intimately familiar with the principle would be that it'd be as if France were plopped down on top of the jurisdiction of Oregon. And our new employee should be conscious of the fact that, in effect, there's a border that across which different laws apply, and that is an issue that ought to be, when they encounter those kinds of issues at the department, they ought to immediately flag those from Ms. Striffler. Well, after one of those sessions, a tribal member who had just been hired by the department came up to me and said, "You know, Pete, I appreciate that you mentioned tribal sovereignty. It's very important to us, but you may have a different idea about it than I do." And I confess that I couldn't immediately see what her point was, but she said, "Don't you have it upside down? You came along and plopped down on top of us. It's not a case of us coming along and plopping down on top of you." And I tell that story on myself because I think it's very easy for those of us who haven't lived the experience to forget what a different perspective that can bring to bear on decision-making and the analysis of policy. The second lesson I've learned about sovereignty is that we've already heard it described in a lot of detail, and I'm going to do the same in terms of the relationship of tribes to the government, to non-tribal government. But sovereignty has another very important feature, and that is that tribes are sovereign as to one another. And that has been alluded to a couple of times here in these proceedings. And so it leads to the lesson that I think is important for all of us to recognize, is that when you deal with an individual representative of a particular tribe, as you're doing now when you hear from me, or you might hear on some other issue, you are dealing with one of the sovereigns, but not all of them. I can't speak for the other tribes any more, perhaps, than you might be able to speak for a resident of Washington in any official capacity. And so that, I think, is an important lesson that I've learned about working in this arena. The third lesson is that I think that all of you on the dais may have quite a lot in common with the leadership of the tribes with whom you will interact on policy issues. We've talked about differences, but one of the important commonalities is that you are all elected officials. My observation of what I've seen of the leadership of tribes, certainly of the tribe that I represent, is that they are very vigorous democratic institutions. And so when you work with a tribal leader, you are likely sitting across the table from someone who has the same kinds of constituent pressures, the same kinds of fiscal impulses, the same kinds of tugs and pulls on priorities within his or her organization as you're struggling with on a day-to-day basis here, and that may be a common ground with the tribal leaders with whom you must interact. And the fourth lesson I've learned is that there are a ton of resources available to help all of us on who don't already know everything there is to know about sovereignty and Indian country. And the first of the two documents that I provided to you in the handouts is intended to give you a leg up on accessing some of those resources. And I hope that you'll look at those materials, and you and your staff perhaps will be able to use those to help as you work your way through the issues that you need to confront. Now, part of the materials there is a very brief bibliography of some of the materials that I've had occasion to look at, and I just want to close this part of my presentation with a comment on one of them. I had thought before I started work in Indian Country that the creation of the National Park System and the Wilderness System later in 1964 was one of the unadulterated public goods of the way we have our society has advanced. But on your reading list is a book that opened my eyes about a year ago, and it's a series of vignettes about an Indian Country perspective on that same story. And you might imagine, as you from what you've heard today and already in your presentation, that from a sovereignty perspective, the story of the establishment of the national parks and the wilderness system may be quite different, differently viewed by the sovereign entities whose lands form the basis for the national parks and the wilderness system today. So, with that much of my own confessions of lessons I've learned, I want to turn briefly to the three issues that specific issues that you've asked me to address. And I, like the other speakers, I won't reiterate the foundational principles of sovereignty, but they might be rightly summarized as saying that the basic rule is that in Indian Country, tribes have exclusive authority. And for the most part, state authority is preempted by federal law. So I want to turn to first to the first of the three topics, and that is public safety. And here I think maybe the greatest intersection of sovereignty and this body's work over time does relate to this law that you heard about, the Public Law 280. And one way to think about that law, that it's helped me think about that law, is that if the general principle is that state authority is preempted in Indian Country and that Indian nations have exclusive authority in Indian Country, then PL 280 is functionally an exception to that rule. That is to say, there are, in PL 280, Congress has delegated to the state of Oregon jurisdiction over most crimes and civil matters in those areas in which PL 280 applies. And you've already heard that it doesn't apply uniformly in Oregon. Three of Oregon's tribes, by one mechanism or another, but the net effect is the same, are not subject to that exemption from the general rule. So with respect to Public Law 280, you have the complication of dealing with tribes in which the as to which the state's criminal jurisdiction does extend, and tribes as to which the state's criminal jurisdiction does not extend. And that is a function of federal law. You can't change that process. You don't have the power to do that. Now, Congress presumably could change the terms of Public Law 280, and indeed it has amended it over time, from time to time. But that is just one of those things that you have to deal with as a reality because your authority in that area is preempted by the federal law. Mr. Dorsey made an important point, and I want to underscore it here, about Public Law 280, and that is that where Public Law 280 does apply, it does not extinguish the authority of the tribe to exercise jurisdiction over its territory. It merely adds side by side or concurrently the state authority. So that's why in the instance he described, you can have the situation in which the two courts might have jurisdiction simultaneously over the same dispute. And likewise it is with respect to criminal jurisdiction. In the PL 280 areas, the tribes are free to enact their own criminal codes or to enact their own civil codes that may stand side by side with overlapping provisions that the state has applied. Let me turn to the second of the three areas, and that's the area of gaming. It clearly does intersect with the principle of sovereignty in ways that make a difference to Oregonians and to Oregon law. Again, start with the proposition that in general, gaming is a question that is reserved to the federal government to regulate. State government is, generally speaking, prevented from acting in that arena. And tribes have exclusive control to govern gaming in Indian Country. And so the story here really is more or less action and reaction. The action is that in 1987, in the Cabazon case, the United States Supreme Court unambiguously held that tribes could had that the general rule applied. Tribes could do gaming on their own lands, and that it was not a matter that the state, in that case, the state of California, could interfere with. And as a result of that, in the reaction phase of that, Congress enacted the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, or IGRA, just in the year following, actually. And from your perspective, one way to think about IGRA is that it created two exceptions to the general preemption of state law with respect to Indian gaming. And so the first is that Congress said, in the exercise of its own power, we will permit the general preemption to be excused or set aside to the extent that states are required to enter into negotiations with tribes for the purpose of establishing compacts or agreements that govern what are defined in IGRA to be Class 3 gaming. And the Act divides different kinds of gaming into various categories and treats them differently for purposes of the preemption and other rules under the Act. And so that's why in Oregon, pursuant to that, in effect, exemption from the general rule, the state of Oregon enters into negotiations with tribes to effectuate compacts that govern the terms under which tribes will operate Class 3 gaming casinos. Now, there is a direct Oregon law interface here that recently has been ruled on by the Oregon courts, and that is the constitutional prohibition against the establishment of a casino. And you might well ask, well, if the Oregon Constitution prohibits the legislature from passing a law authorizing the creation of a casino, how could the legislature have passed a law that authorizes the governor to enter into a compact that grants a tribe the right to establish a casino? And the reason goes back to the basic rule, which is that the Oregon constitutional prohibition simply does not apply in Indian country. So that's why the governor, it's constitutional for you all to have authorized, as you did, the governor to execute these compacts, but it wouldn't be constitutional for you all just by statute to say we're going to authorize the creation of a casino elsewhere, because the Constitution forbids that. Now, the other relevant exemption to the general rule in the gaming area that I think you might that does directly engage the state, although not the legislative branch, is the prohibition that's contained within IGRA on what are called after-acquired lands. So remember, it's an action-reaction mode, and you might imagine that part of the reaction of Congress was to try and limit the spread of what it viewed to be the uncontrolled expansion of Indian gaming. And so it prohibited in IGRA the establishment of Class 3 facilities on after-acquired lands, but there are many exceptions to that prohibition. So it's an exception to the exception, which brings you back to the general rule. So really, when you hear people talk about an exception to the IGRA prohibition on after-acquired lands, what they're really saying is that the general rule of exclusive Indian jurisdiction applies and has not been displaced by IGRA. And one of those is the question of establishment of a gaming facility on after-acquired lands. And there, in IGRA, Congress granted the state's power to participate substantively in at least one of those kinds of decision-making processes if the federal government finds that a proposal on to do Indian gaming on after-acquired land is in the best interest of a tribe, wouldn't be detrimental to the surrounding community, and the governor concurs in the findings, then under those circumstances, the general rule of exclusivity is waived, and the tribe cannot proceed with that activity. So there's a direct waiver by Congress of the general proposition. So that's the, there are many, many complicated exceptions to the rules under IGRA, but I've given you just a two that I think bear most directly on sovereignty. Finally, as to taxes, the general rule is, again, exclusive control by the tribe in Indian country and preemption of state law in Indian country. Now, I want to use specifically tax issues that are linked to economic development in Indian country as an illustration of some of these principles, and then I'll be done. Clearly, every tribe is trying to broaden its economic and diversify its economic base, and those forms of activity take many, many different forms, and they vary from tribe to tribe. Tribes have very different and opportunities and strategies in that respect. But many of those activities involve the leasing of tribal land to an economic development partner under one form of development enterprise or another. And here there are some direct engagements with the principle of sovereignty, and I think this is one of the areas in which you can expect to have to grapple with these issues as time goes on in your responsibilities. So you start with the proposition that tribal lands that are acquired through the trust process established in 1934 by the Indian Reorganization Act are flatly exempt from state or local taxation. If the statute says that if the lands are taken into trust pursuant to that act, then a tribe cannot tax the activity on those lands. So, for example, a use tax on permanent improvements that a tribe has installed on trust land or otherwise on trust land is not subject to taxation. But is the income from a lease, is that something that could be taxed by the state? And, of course, these begin to be gray area questions in which the general rule applies, but the matter of trying to interpret and apply it to the specific circumstances becomes difficult. And so there are some states, some rulings from several federal courts that hold that, lease income from leased land is a, if a state purports to tax that income, then that is a tax that is prohibited by the general rule and by Section 465 of the Indian Reorganization Act. And so that's challenged. But I've given you the citation to a couple of those cases, and if you go look at those, you'll see the court struggling to make sure that it understands exactly how the general rule applies in the specific cases. So the general rule is pretty clear, but the application of it in a particular case is sometimes very difficult. Another question that is challenging in this area, and again, it is a function of applying a pretty clear general rule to a specific circumstance, is trying to figure out where the legal incidence of a tax lies. Because if the tax is on the tribe itself, then it's clearly preempted and clearly prohibited by federal law. But if the tax is actually being paid, if the legal incidence of the tax rests on somebody other than the tribe, then maybe that is something that the state has a better shot at being able to tax, or local jurisdiction. So when you look at some of these issues, a very difficult question is trying to figure out where the burden of that tax actually rests. Where is the legal incidence of that tax? And again, that can be a challenging problem. And if you look at the Seminole Tribe of Florida case, a district court case that's very recently been decided, you'll see the federal district court judge there trying to figure out from an unclear tax scheme, in that case Florida, who it is who has to actually pay that tax. Because if it turns out that it's actually the tribe that pays it, then it's preempted. So that's legal incidence of tax is an area that is very difficult to determine, even though the general principle is pretty clear. Now, even if the legal incidence of the tax falls on the tribe's non-Indian joint venture developer, it's still possible that the general rule of preemption applies. And that might occur if a court concluded that taxing the tribe's partner is tantamount to taxing the tribe itself. If it's functionally the same thing as taxing the tribe, then you have a situation where you're back in the general rule. the tribe is immune from tax. And here, the United States Supreme Court has created an elaborate balancing test. It's in the White Mountain Apache Tribe versus Bracker case. And as you probably have run into such things before, but balancing tests are very hard for courts to apply, and they tend to be very variable from fact pattern to fact pattern. So that's another area that's a problem. And so both the state of Oregon and the United States government have stepped into these areas of uncertainty to try and provide certainty. And most recently, and I'll end here, the United States has amended certain of its administrative rules to help provide clarity to tribes, tax authorities, and would-be joint venture developers about when a leasehold or possessory interest is or isn't subject to the exemption. And so I'll just end there with the proposition that I think in that rulemaking and in some of the statutes that this body has passed in the past, such as the action it took to define what a governmental service is with respect to tribes and thus exempt from taxation and what is not, that shows this body and other legislative bodies stepping into this uncertainty to provide certainty for all the parties, even though you're all operating against a backdrop of what appear on their face to be pretty clear and certain rules. So I will end with that.
Mr. Hicks.
Thank you. Mr. Shepard, is there somewhere, either in a compact or federal code somewhere, a provision regarding a radius, supposedly, maybe after acquired property or otherwise, of 50 miles, supposedly, of where a Indian real property could be situated, as in there must be a radius between tribal property? Do you know of anything of that sort?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, I do not. The Indian Reorganization Act generally permits tribes to acquire property in various geographic regions. Some individual tribes may have individual statutory limitations on where they can seek to take property into trust, but I'm not aware of any general limitation. I stand to be corrected if any of my more expert colleagues in the back are looking daggers, but I think that's the general principle.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Pete, I just want some clarification. Getting back to the leasing description that you were given earlier. If I am a farmer from Madras and I lease property on the local tribal land there, I am not a member, am I subject to taxes?
Well, that you may not be. And it may depend in part on the Bracker balancing test, and under that test, one part of the analysis would be weighing such. I frankly find it very difficult to conceive of how a court could, really effectively do this. But this is the challenge, nonetheless, that the Supreme Court set out. The court is supposed to looking at the question of whether you're subject to taxation or not. The court is supposed to look at things like the tribal government interest in facilitating your activity and somehow weigh that against the state's interest in taxing that activity. And one thing that does emerge from the cases interpreting that rule is that it's not sufficient to tip the balance in favor of taxation by the state simply to say that the state has a general interest in raising money for the good of the order for the general fund. There has to be, it's a more specific analysis than that. But so that's part of the reason why I think there's been an effort, at least at the federal level, in terms of these regulations to try and define with more certainty. And I do think that's an area where you might very well be asked to look at whether there's something legislature can do to help provide certainty in those arenas. Because obviously, as an economic development partner of the tribe, the one thing you want more than anything else is have certainty about what your tax exposure is going to be before you enter into the agreement.
Yeah, just a follow-up with that, Mr. Chair. Okay. So yes. I'm a member, and I reside in Madras, and I'm leasing property from, let's say, a brother there, in Warm Springs on their reservation. Does that bring more clarity to no?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I anticipated that it was very likely that the surface would be scratched below my level, and I asked Mr. Dorsey and Mr. Mason to stand by for just such a possibility. So
this is the Perry Mason moment.
No, it's a complicated thing, but I think generally it's Indian land that's exempt from income. So, for example, if you're a non-Indian farmer, your income is still subject most likely to state income tax. But if you have permanent improvements or other improvements you make to that land, those are likely exempt from state taxation. Is that?
It's not the first time I've been corrected by Mr. Dorsey.
No. Probably won't be the last. Doesn't always listen to me.
And there would be no property tax on it.
That's correct.
Mr. Dorsey, can you just once again be sure you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. Yes, Craig Dorsey.
Thank
again.
You.
There is some question, which isn't answered, about the value of the lease. And that's one of the things that these new regulations attempt to address, but whether that's clear or not is not clear.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Representative. Thanks. For either witness. So picking up a little bit on that thread, the kind of obscure hypothetical, if you'll indulge me, though. So the state is constitutionally obligated to use its revenue from forest property to benefit the common school fund. And if the state, what would happen if the state entered into a lease type agreement with a tribe? Would the state's constitutional obligation to use revenue for that purpose be overridden? Very obscure hypothetical. And I don't put you on the spot, but
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understand it.
If the state leased the forest property to a tribe, what would happen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, you mean what part of that would be taxable?
Would the state then be subject to the constitutional requirement that it use revenue from the forest property to benefit the common school fund?
Oh, I see.
And you probably, because Elliott State Forest, so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, I actually think that's not a question of Indian law as much as it is of state law and the obligations that are attendant to this body's responsibility to protect the common school fund and the sources of it. So I think the resource base for the answer to your question is not Indian law. It is the question of under what circumstances can this body redirect money to a different purpose that otherwise would have been used for common school fund purposes.
Could I just one follow-up? So what I'm talking about is a lease arrangement, though, with a tribe, which picks up a little bit on the thread of the last Representative Olson's question in regards to whose law controls then. Because it sounds like there are circumstances in which the Oregon Constitution is inapplicable on Indian real property.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sorry, I still don't get it. And I'd be happy to talk with you afterwards.
We got to sell the Elliott State Forest for reasons that, because we have to abide by the state constitution. And so I'm asking hypothetically, what would happen if we entered into a lease arrangement with a tribe?
Sorry, Craig Dorsey again. So you're talking about leasing state land, not leasing tribal land. The exemption applies to leasing tribal land.
Okay.
As I think Pete said, state law would apply to the lease of state land.
Okay, thanks.
Anything further, Senator?
Yeah, I just want to say that one of the times when this whole conversation in the legislature became, I don't know if it was clear, but at least we had to come up and understand the sovereignty was about Senate Bill 412. And Senator Farioli brought that bill to us, and it had to do with tribal police and our police. And in this next session, we'll get to have a conversation about that again, because it is sunsetting. And so we need to start really understanding it. And I think one of the aspects that came out in the conversation today was why it was different for different tribes. There were three tribes that there was a whole lot of sovereignty that they had to really consider when dealing with that, because they didn't have to worry about the state coming on their reservation and imposing the laws, because they were exempt. Only the 280 group, the other six, who already had a relationship where the state could come on and impose their laws, It was different for them. So it's a real interesting conversation, and hopefully will help us understand clearly the idea that was just expressed is that there are nine sovereigns here. This isn't about a sovereign nation or the native sovereignty. It's about nine separate sovereign nations within our borders that all have to come to understandings if they're going to move forward on this kind of stuff. And I hope that as we get going in this next session, we have real conversations and people get to better understand that whole idea about how those intersections happen and how just the fact that we said tribal police could act on our in the state property, it was a different issue with respect to some of those tribes, and I hope we understand that. And I know Pete does.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next item on the agenda is due process considerations in guardianship of adults. Tim Ney and Judge Welch, please. And Representative Demereaux, I'm sorry, Senator Demereaux would like to make a few comments.
Thank you, Chair Barker. colleagues, first of all, let me say I really appreciate having this topic on the agenda today. This is an issue that I've been working with since my very first session here when I was on the Human Services Committee, and the chair, Representative Tomei, volunteered me to serve on a task force, and Vice Chair Olson, whose job it was to protect me from such things, failed to do his duty there. And so I found myself on the House Bill 2883 task force, which was to look at the state creating an office of a public guardian conservator. And that became a long-term commitment for me and ultimately a real passion. And one of the real pleasures of that was to serve on the task force that was chaired by Judge Betsy Welch. We worked really hard on this issue, and as you may recall, finally, in this last session in 2014, we were able to find the funding to create a public guardian office within the long-term care ombudsman process. One of the issues that came up during those deliberations were, well, you know, let me say that we recognize the need for many potentially protected persons to have the benefit of a public guardian. But as you know, guardianship is a very serious step to take in terms of the potential to infringe on the civil liberties of the protected persons. And one of the things that we learned, or I learned in the course of this, was that Oregon was a state and one of the only, if not the only, state in the nation that does not have a mandatory hearing for a guardianship decision, nor does the person in need of a guardian have a right to counsel in such cases. And this was clearly put on the agenda of the committee is something that needed to be addressed. When we were first looking at this, of course, we were at the height of the recession, and you know, just getting the office established was a lift. But this remains an ongoing need, and I'm really grateful that Judge Welch and Mr. Ney, who's a real expert in this area as well, can help explain this issue to us.
All right. Well, with that, thank you very much, Senator, for the opening remarks. We're going to go ahead and start our presentation on the due process of consideration of guardianship of adults. And we do have Mr. Ney and the Honorable Elizabeth Welch. So however you want to do your presentation, please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair, members of the committees, thank you so much for having us and giving us this opportunity to tell you a little bit about guardianship in the trenches, which is certainly the experience that Judge Welch and I have had. My name is Tim Ney. I'm a practicing attorney in Portland. My practice specializes in issues related to loss of capacity, estate planning, and protective proceedings. I've been doing this for 30 years and have the pleasure of saying I appeared before Judge Welch in many, many instances. I wanted to start by a couple of general descriptions, and that is, what is a guardianship? And a guardianship is the culmination of a court process in which an attorney files pleadings in a local circuit court to create what's called a protected person, as Senator Dembro mentioned. A protected person is someone who is found by the court to lack capacity in specific statutory ways that means they can't take care of themselves. Who is subject to guardianship? Your father is 89 years old, moderate to severe dementia. Your mother, 87. They've been living in the home all their lives since the diagnosis 7, 8, 10 years ago. Your mother has cared for your father 24/7, which is an impossible task for any spousal or family caregiver to do all alone until the individual dies from Alzheimer's disease. Your mother is about to fall apart physically, emotionally, and she needs relief. There's no other family member who can do anything to help your mother. So your father needs placement in a 24/7 care facility. Problem is, he refuses to go. No care facility will take him if he has the wherewithal to be able to say, "You can't keep me here. I don't want to be here. I'm going to hire a lawyer and I'm going to sue." Your child is 27 years old, was diagnosed with Down syndrome at age 4. Your child is now an orphan. Neither parent lives. Someone has to make critical decisions about placement, about medical care, must have the authority to make medical decisions for this child. Your brother is 42 years old, and on his first drive on his brand new Harley, he set it down on the top deck of the Markham Bridge. This is actually a client that I had. Shortly after his return from Afghanistan, being a war veteran, a combat veteran, he decided a helmet was something for sissies. His head struck the curb on the top deck. He sustained a severe traumatic brain injury and no longer will be able to make any decision of any kind about any aspect of his life. Your next door neighbor is someone who is 97 years old, has been fiercely independent, and finally you as the neighbor realize that your neighbor can no longer live alone safely. Your neighbor has outlived friends, family, other caregivers, and now someone has to make the decision to place your neighbor in a 24/7 care facility. The people that we see on the streets of Portland, who live on the streets of Portland, who have chronic mental illness, who are penniless, these are the people who tend not to be subject to guardianship proceedings, because a guardianship proceeding is very expensive. Lawyers have to be hired to file a petition to appoint a guardian. Someone has to be named as the proposed guardian. An independent investigator for the court, called a court visitor, usually a psychologist, an MD, an RN, or other experienced person, has to go out and do an investigation to see if a guardianship is appropriate, if the proposed guardian is suitable to be a guardian, and thus approximately $2,000 to $5,000 is spent in the process of appointing a guardian. People on the street don't have those kinds of resources, nor anyone in their friendship or family networks who can afford that kind of money. So those people generally don't end up as people under guardianship. Guardianship next to criminal incarceration or civil commitment because an individual represents a danger to self or others or can no longer provide for their own basic needs for health and welfare. These are the individuals that are subject to guardianships, and as a result, this process takes away their ability to say where I want to live, who I want to see, what my medical care is going to be, and that represents a very, very supreme degradation of civil rights under the Oregon and U.S. Constitution. So that's the who and the what of guardianship. I'm now going to turn to Judge Welch to talk about right to counsel and hearing.
Just so it's in perspective, I'm Elizabeth Welch. I'm a senior circuit court judge, having served in Multnomah County for a long time, and I was the chief probate judge in Portland for many years. The public guardian population are the people that counsel has just described. In other words, the people for whom there is no money, there is no appropriate family resource, there's nobody to serve. And so those people are the people who sleep under bridges and are run through police departments on a regular basis, are the nemesis of emergency rooms in hospitals. They're using up public resources, but it's just the original revolving door much more than many other places where that particular metaphor is used. I think the critical thing to bear in mind in looking at right to counsel is that the people we're talking about, whether they're moneyed people or absolutely destitute people, are not interested or willing to get the services they need. In other words, if somebody was willing to volunteer to go into a program or get the kind of in-home care that would allow them to live appropriately, we wouldn't be talking about them. It would happen. So these are people who are either unwilling or unable to consent to appropriate care. A little background might be helpful. Senator Dimbro mentioned that Oregon is the only state in the union that does not require a hearing in every guardianship matter. That's an important issue. We don't have enough time today to talk about that. I want to talk about right to counsel because it's more important, frankly. Oregon law does provide that people have the right to counsel. We are one of three states, as far as I can count, maybe as many as five, who have no provision for the payment of the cost of counsel for people in this general category. In other words, I can tell you with some certainty that in 27 states, the appointment of counsel for a person in any guardianship proceeding is mandatory and automatic. 27 states at public expense. In another 19 states, for a total of 46 states, public monies will be used to provide counsel on the request of the respondent, in other words, the person whose liberty we're talking about, on the direction of the court visitor, or because a objection has been made to the proceeding by someone else, usually another relative, and those are complicated situations. So we're down to Oregon and Mississippi, by the way, for your information, that do not provide a paid counsel for people who cannot afford a counsel and are in this situation. The question that we had on this task force, and that I think you were going to have to address sometime soon, I hope, is how broad the right to counsel needs to be here. And I think the first issue is there are a lot of people who go through this process who are not even capable of communicating. A person who has serious brain damage, who is profoundly suffering from dementia, who simply cannot communicate, wouldn't have anything to say to a lawyer, would not have any comprehension of what was going on, was not objecting because they, again, don't know what's going on. So if you're talking about the possibilities, the idea of everybody getting a lawyer has a certain symmetry to it. You know, if you believe in a principle, then do it. The reality is that there is a cut of people, and I can't give you a percentage or a guess, that have no use for an attorney, and there's really, you know, there's a real question about that. The next category would be where the individual objects to the proceeding. And for those of you who are not familiar with court procedure on this subject, when someone is served with a petition for guardianship, there's a little slip of paper called the blue form in there that the individual, it's very simple, straightforward. You required it about 15 years ago. And it says, I object. You know, you just check the box there, or I object to this person being my guardian. That objection goes to the court, and then the case is considered contested. They don't have to have a lawyer to do that. They can do it on their own. So that's one way the court finds out that there's a contest. The next way is that somebody objects, a sister, a brother, often it's a spouse, lots of different circumstances. And finally, court visitors, as counsel indicated, go out in every case, and one of the things they're supposed to report is whether the person wants this to happen or doesn't, or if there are some dynamics in the family that are really kind of scary, they will occasionally say to the court, this person really needs a lawyer. This is a mess for a variety of different circumstances. That's the middle ground, is to say under those kinds of circumstances, the court may or shall, hopefully shall, appoint counsel. But the real issue here is paying for it. And then finally, another alternative would be to address the population covered by the public guardian itself. This is a fairly narrow band of people. The proceeding is, in fact, brought by a public agency, making it somewhat comparable to a civil commitment. And these people are, by definition, indigent, or they wouldn't be there. This would be a very good place to start. The fact that someone is guilty of the crime they're charged with doesn't mean they don't need a lawyer. The fact that a person has dementia and can't take care of themselves doesn't mean that they don't need to be guided through this process. One of the most important elements of the representation of people in these proceedings is not so much whether or not there should be a guardian, but who the guardian should be. And that, if from a standpoint of a judge, the hearings we have in this area are rarely about whether there should be a guardian. It is almost, I would say, close to 90% of the time, it is whether daughter A or daughter B, who are ready to murder each other, should do this. And sometimes these are very, very difficult situations. So this is a really important interest, and I'll give you one example why. Counsel mentioned that one of the things that a guardian can do, beside putting you someplace where you don't want to be, is they can also control who you have contact with. So if you imagine to yourself a nice, messy, multi-generation family dysfunctionality where there are groupings of people and you don't talk across the DMZ, this kind of issue, if the wrong person's the guardian and says, well, nobody from from Camp B gets to come and visit Mama in the nursing home, and the guardian has that authority. So there are a lot of interests at stake here, but I just want to echo Mr. May's comments. This is a tremendous intrusion on people's dignity. And people will say, when I would call people in chambers when I still did this, and I would say, do you want a lawyer? Because somebody said you might want a lawyer, or you're objecting but you don't have a lawyer. Do you want a lawyer? I haven't done anything wrong. What do I need a lawyer for? And these people could be very, this lady could have been senile and she could have not been. I mean, it's a perfectly understandable attitude to have. What have I done that I'm even here? And now you're telling me I need to have a lawyer? Do I need to have a lawyer, Judge? You know, and you might guess what I would say when they asked me, and I won't say. Now, I want to tell you how we cope with this now. And I do this with trepidation. But if we get if judges, particularly in the large jurisdictions, large counties, get a reason to believe that somebody needs a lawyer, I'll just leave it at that, what we do is that we appoint competent counsel. They do get to say no if they really don't want to take another case. It's pro bono. They do it because they're good guys, and the Elder Bar are full of wonderful lawyers and wonderful people. It's not fair. Why should they bear this expense? And more, perhaps more important than that argument, because you may not find that totally convincing, in smaller communities, that is totally impractical. For a judge to, you know, there's one lawyer in town that does this kind of work. Is that lawyer always going to get those cases? It's not fair. And I'm on the Public Defense Services Commission, and years ago when I was first starting to work on this, we kind of took a look at how much it would cost for this kind of lawyer for the Public Defense Service Commission to pay for. And it's in the misdemeanor civil commitment range. These are not tremendously complex cases. We believe it would not, particularly if it were just talking about the public guardian, maybe as a starting point or as an option, that we're not talking about a lot of expense or a lot of money. Thank you for listening. I want to stop before you throw something at me.
Anybody have any questions for Representative Barton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so the committee has the kind of the whole picture, can one of you summarize what happens to the protected person after a guardianship is established?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, that is the other very, very problematic aspect of guardianship for a number of reasons. And I did want to add that it's real easy for every one of us in this room right this second to say, guardianship doesn't affect me or my family. It's real easy to dismiss this. But be aware that every one of us in this room right this moment is one good thump on the head away from being permanently incapacitated. And this issue all of a sudden is about you. And judges like Judge Welch and other judges around Oregon Circuit Courts could be dealing with the matter of the guardianship of any one of us. Now, once the guardianship is in place, Oregon law only requires that once a year, the guardian, who is appointed by the court, submit what's called a guardian's report to the court, talking very, very superficially about what's going on with this protected person. In many instances, the guardians don't file the guardian's report at all. Then, if a guardian's report is submitted, human nature means that it's going to reflect that everything is okay. If things aren't okay, the court has no idea whatsoever. This is where the recently formed nonprofit Special Advocates for Vulnerable Oregonians, which is a 501c3, looks at exactly answering your question, Representative Martin. It's an organization of volunteer guardianship monitors, people like any of us, who are recruited, screened, trained, and supervised, and then appointed by the court to go out and actually visit your father, your grandfather, your next door neighbor, your child, to look at the medical records potentially, to look at the conditions and the quality of life that this individual, the protected person, is living at that point. And without this, courts really, because of inadequate staffing, based on the number of guardianship cases that each circuit court in Oregon is holding, there is really no telling if that protected person is enjoying any quality of life, receiving any reasonable medical care, or is being abused, neglected, or exploited. And that's where the formation of SAVO, as we call it, Special Advocates for Vulnerable Oregonians, is trying to bridge the gap to assist the courts in actually monitoring what's happening to these people and whether the guardian is really looking out for the best interests of this individual. And in years to come, hopefully you'll hear more about SAVO as we continue to train guardians to develop program evaluation measures that show the difference that we make in our beta test in Multnomah County, which was an experimental initial application of this concept and model. We found out of 17 protected people who were monitored by a SAVO volunteer that there were five that the court, after receiving the report from the volunteer, cited the appointed guardian. Three of them were removed. That is an incredible percentage. If you extrapolate that out to the approximately 5,000 to 7,000 people in Oregon right now who are subject to guardianship, the majority being in Multnomah County, those numbers mean people who are defenseless, who are unable to advocate for themselves, are not being treated in a way that if it was us under guardianship, that we would want our quality of life to enjoy. And as a result, this model that was borrowed from a joint venture between AARP and the American Bar Association several years ago established a number of these volunteer guardianship monitoring programs. Unfortunately, now only five are still functioning. The other core mission of SAVO is, all right, so you're appointed a guardian for your spouse, your child, your parent, your neighbor, for anyone. You aren't a professional fiduciary. You aren't a lawyer. You have really no idea what you're supposed to do. Do we have any mechanism to give you information about what your duties are, what the ethical ramifications of this incredible power that you hold? No. We have no training. We have no way of helping these lay fiduciaries, as we call them. And our second core mission of SAVO is to develop Oregon's first program to educate lay people on what the role of being guardian is all about. Now, Washington has had this program for years. Idaho has had an education program for years. California has had an education program for years. Oregon does not have this program. And currently, we are gearing up to be able to provide, ultimately, on-demand video training mandated by every court in Oregon that has the authority to appoint a guardian. And so far, through Catherine Tennyson, judge of the Multnomah County Circuit Court Probate Department, the response to the idea of having this training that any circuit court judge in Oregon could say to a lay fiduciary, you will take this training and show that you've completed it, the response from the other judges has been overwhelming. So we're doing everything we can to get this in place as soon as possible.
Representative Krieger?
I've been on this Judiciary Committee 14 years, not an attorney, but every one of us over that time has come to understand, if you're talking criminal law, and because I've been involved in dependency, where the most crucial thing is having competent legal representation, it follows everything that we do in the courtroom. You have to have competent attorneys representing people, and it's going to cost them money. And we have to find a way to do it. Now, we're already talking about DHS not representing itself in the courtroom. That's going to cost money. But in the long term, there's a little thing I keep referring to, and some of them know what I'm going to say. The word justice needs to prevail, and it's going to cost money, but it also affects people's lives. So we need to concentrate on it.
Anything further? Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Okay. The next item on the agenda is results of evaluation of Measure 57 in the drug courts. Mr. Prinz.
Yeah, Alan.
And Kelly. I
believe you left the wall. Did you let it happen? I can't believe it. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Craig Prinz. Carl, as he was leaving, said, don't take this personally. I won't. And we're going to keep this short. So what we wanted to do is we have some outcomes from a study that Kelly Officer and my staff worked on that we started in 2009 that show that drug courts are, I think, a good investment for property offenders. And so we're going to... basically, we just wanted to let you all know that we had the capacity to do this type of study, a random controlled trial, and let you know some of the results of the outcomes of that. So I'm just going to go over four numbers so I can make sure just have the background, and I'll become Kelly's clicker person. So Senate Bill 267, and I wanted to just say, too, that Representative Olson and Senator Prezansky are on the Criminal Justice Commission, and so... appreciate their leadership and work with us. Senate Bill 267 passed in 2003 through this Judiciary Committee really is a signal for Oregon. We try to rely on evidence-based practices. We try to look at things that have been proven by science to work to reduce recidivism. Is kind of the guidepost we use to figure out, well, let's focus on evaluations that are really rigorous. And so when Measure 57 passed in 2008, it made it more likely that more people would go to prison on property offenses. And so in 2009, after that passed, we had the stimulus funds. And we were thinking back then about, well, what we want to give judges and prosecutors and defense attorneys and ultimately citizens an option other than prison for these nonviolent offenses. And so we elected in 2009 to invest a substantial part of the Byrne JAG grant, the stimulus funds, in looking at Measure 57 eligible drug courts. So these would be drug courts for property offenders who are really a high risk to not do well on probation. We screen them to make sure that we're focusing on those who are addicted to drugs. And we put out an RFP for several counties to do that. You then fast forward to 3194 that passed last session, amended Senate Bill 267 and said, when it's possible, when it's appropriate, try to use a random controlled trial as you're doing the outcomes. And so we just wanted to demonstrate that we can do that and just give you kind of that context of how that will look in the future. So Kelly, why don't you go ahead and I'll just click for it. Oh, I can do this one. So really when we talk about evidence-based practices, what we're trying to do is only look at things that have been rigorously tested, scientifically tested, and proven to actually work. There was a study in 1997 Congress did with an eminent criminologist named Lawrence Sherman. And really he, I think, really pushed the whole country forward by saying, too often this has been an art and not a science. We try things, see if they work. We don't really evaluate them. And so he really pushed it forward by looking at all of the studies that he could, and he created a scale to think about, okay, I've got all these studies. Which ones of them are rigorous enough internally? They have enough internal validity that we can say, you know, this is proof that this is the kind of thing that we should say definitively works. Okay, yeah. And that's the Maryland scale, and that really was the start of what we would call meta-analysis in this area, where you look at a bunch of studies and see if you can take something from that whole body of science. I think I hit this one too.
Okay, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Kelly Officer with the Criminal Justice Commission. And as Craig mentioned, the meta-analysis is a study of studies, so we want to look at that to combine the rigorous scientifically based research from a large number of studies to figure out an overall effect size. So instead of looking at one study that's been done in one place, even though it might be a very well-designed and rigorous study, instead look at the entire body of work that's been done on that program and use that to decide on the effectiveness of the program overall. Some of the shortcomings to keep in mind when looking at that type of research, this is from Rethinking Rehabilitation by Farabee. The top one is the lack of random assignment. There really are a small number of random assignment studies in criminal justice in general, and that's slowly changing. We have done one that we're going to highlight with you, and more and more are being done, but in the body of research, it's still a very small number of studies. Also, the difference in follow-up periods, use of dropouts as comparison subjects, and the failure to use the right statistical controls to account for differences in demographics and criminal history variables across the two groups. Okay, next one. So the Maryland scale tells us that the, quote, gold standard of program evaluation is a random assignment study that will compare units to program and comparison groups. So it greatly mitigates selection bias and is the gold standard in program evaluations. In subsettings, it's not feasible or is unethical to do a random control trial. So in those situations, you would have to do some kind of a well-designed quasi-experimental study where you're going to have to come up with a control group through some other method than random assignment. So you can do a very rigorous study in that manner in those situations. So ideally, you do an RCT, but if you can't, then you do a very well-designed quasi-experimental design. So the Criminal Justice Commission did a randomized controlled trial study that we are very proud of and wanted to share some of the details of that with you today. It was on Measure 57 drug courts. So there were four counties that participated in this study, Multnomah, Jackson, Umatilla, and Douglas. So these studies agreed to randomly assign participants to either the Measure 57 drug court or to probation as usual. And the drug courts were designed as intensive drug courts for medium to high risk property offenders. Historically, drug courts were designed for drug offenders, sometimes lower level, low risk drug offenders. So in this study, we wanted to apply that same drug court program to the medium and high-risk property offenders, some of which were prison eligible under Measure 57. So it was a slightly different population than what drug courts were used for historically, and we did this randomized controlled trial of these courts in Oregon. So to do this random assignment study, it must be ethical and feasible. So we had to go through an institutional review board to protect the rights of human research participants. And the study was designed to randomly assign participants to either the drug court or probation as usual, where they would also receive some form of treatment through that path. So you can't have a study that's designed where it's going to deny someone treatment, because that is where you get into the ethical issues of the study. So there's a large amount of planning and work on the front end of the study. The planning and the grants began in 2009. Dr. Paul Bellotti with Department of Corrections and Oregon Youth Authority was the principal investigator of the study, as well as Dr. Mark Eddy, who is on the Criminal Justice Commission. And through their expertise, they helped us design that study and also helped us to go through the process of getting it reviewed and approved through an institutional review board, which takes quite a bit of planning and work up front. The randomization began in 2010 and 2011 and was completed through March of 2013. And this is the area, I think, where we, the CJC, underestimated the amount of work that that would take. You really need to have a strong partnership with the programs and really need to spend a lot of time with them to set up that randomization procedure. They're used to doing it in a certain way, and you're going in and saying, no, we want you to randomly do this now. So it's a challenging thing to do with them. You need to have a lot of collaboration and a lot of partnership with them to be able to pull that off. And then we have preliminary results available now in 2014 that we'll share with you. So again, those in the study, they qualified to be in the study and consented to be in the study, and then were randomly assigned to either drug court or probation as usual. So this random assignment design greatly mitigates the selection bias that would be seen on that. And it's a level 5 on the Maryland scale, so it's the most rigorous program evaluation design that we could do. We have done preliminary analysis of some outcome results, so we have 1-year new charge rates for all participants in the study. So for those that entered the study, we looked at 1 year from randomization and looked to see if there was a new charge in the OGEN data, in the court case data. And then if there was, we said, okay, that person has recidivated. So we could look at the percentage who had recidivated in the drug court group compared to the percentage who had recidivated in the control group. So that's what this next slide will show. This bar graph shows those recidivism rates across the two groups. So the blue bar is the drug court group, and then the blue bar is the control group, the probation as usual group, and the orange bar is the drug court group. And so, and we have this broken out into a couple of different measures. So the top bar is any charge, then we have felony and misdemeanor charge, so just looking at different subgroups of the types of crimes that could be committed. And then we have person, property, drug, and other charges. So you can see for all of these different measures, the blue bar is longer than the orange bar. So the control group had a higher number of participants that recidivated within 1 year than the drug court group did on all of these measures. For a 1 year outcome look, these are pretty promising measures. The difference between these two bars would be the effect size. So for that any charge rate, we have about a 20% drop, so about a 20% effect size for the drug court group. So the drug court group had about a 20% drop in the overall recidivism rate compared to the control group. So when we analyze this statistically, we want to look to see if this difference is what we call statistically significant. So for the any charge group, we did not get to that statistical significance level, but for a 1 year outcome, it's promising, and we're going to keep tracking it at the 2 year and the 3 year mark. So since we didn't get to that statistical significance level, we could say that we could have observed this difference by chance, and we're not completely sure that there is a true difference between the two groups yet. We did get to that statistical significance level for the drug charges, that's why it's circled in the red, and I apologize, for some reason our value didn't come through there, but I believe that recidivism rate was about 11%. Is that, yeah, that looks right on the bar. Yeah, about 11%. So for the drug charges specifically, we did see that significant drop in the recidivism rate, which is also pretty promising for the 1 year outcome. So We will continue to track this study. Just want to iterate that it's taken 5 years to pull this off, so it does take a lot of planning and work up front, but it can be done, and we were able to do it as a state agency, which we are very proud of. The full report is available on our website, and we're going to continue to analyze this data and continue to track these participants through in this study. So thank you very much, and we'll take any questions. Okay.
Questions, Representative Hicks.
On slide 10, you have traditional probation. Are you talking supervised, unsupervised, or a mix?
It would have been, Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, it would have been supervised formal probation. And which, by the way, this is not a competition like we want to see if drug court's better than probation. You couldn't do drug court for everybody. But this would, in this case, it would have been a formal probation, Representative. Okay. So it had been 18 months usually on these type of cases where they'd been formal probation. And I just think that this study shows drug court, is one of many services you want to have in place. You want services that are right for different types of offenders. And it just seems like for that type of fairly high-risk property offender, it's pretty promising when compared to just normal probation.
Thanks.
Okay. Representative Barton.
Thank you. Can you clarify, I just want to make sure, I think that these are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
The Hope Court, which was mm-hmm. much hype in 2009-10, mm-hmm. and the Drug Court, these are two different things. What has happened to Hope? Can you?
Mm-hmm. I mean,
just make that clear in my mind.
Yeah,
please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton. Hope, of course, you have right. a pilot in Clackamas County that's been going since. Is it 2009? It's been going for quite a while.
It was planned then.
And that is a federal grant, and right. so the feds are engaged in a random control trial of that. Hope is a certain type of specialty court. It was created in Hawaii, mm-hmm. where they don't have sentencing guidelines. They don't have the ability to do intermediate sanctions. And so it's just another, it's not a drug court. You're right, it's different. We tend to screen at the front end. So we say we only should have participants that are high risk and have a drug problem. Hope, I would say, what Judge Alm did is he kind of lets people select themselves into sanctions. So it's more open to everyone. And it's designed to really give, the Hawaii and that judge the ability to give intermediate sanctions. So when someone is not doing what they need to do, they can give them a few days jail. They can do some kind of sanction rather than what they would normally do is just send them to prison after mm-hmm. 9 months of screwing up. So I think Hope and drug court are different. They're different models, but I think both can fit into different. We want to have different interventions for different people.
I had the opportunity to go to a criminal justice conference in August and listen to Judge Alm speak on Hope Court, which was
right here once several years ago.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it was very beneficial. So he talked about now today he is residing over a Hope Court and a drug court. Kind of has a tiered system. So people start on regular probation if they are having trouble complying, then they go into Hope Court, and then if they're having trouble, if they need additional treatment, if they're really trying but they're just having, if they're struggling to stay clean and do the mm-hmm. things that they need to do, then from there they'll put them into the drug court. So they kind of have that tiered approach to it in Hawaii that he's done now. He said a lot of the clients are able to stay clean without any type of treatment, mm-hmm. and so I think, as Craig said, those would probably be the lower risk offenders, and then those who are ready to put forth the effort into treatment and are just struggling, then they'll put them into the drug court for those more intense services.
Thank you.
Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know, Kelly or Craig, who this question is for, but are similar analyses being done on various types of specialty courts? Because we've gotten in a little bit into the specialty court mm-hmm. business, which mm-hmm. I think is great. But if we have veterans courts and mental health courts, among others, do we have any sense of whether or not this holds true for specialty courts, mm-hmm. or if this is simply a drug court model?
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Williamson, so when we go back to that, the Maryland scale and the broad scientific evidence, the strongest evidence is for adult criminal drug courts. And then all of these specialty courts, I would say, as you get away from that, it's kind of the wheelhouse, and that's where our most of the money that we invest statewide is in kind of an adult criminal. But then as we go out, we've done studies of a family drug court. I don't think we've done one of a veterans court, but we've done not a random control trial, because as you can see, it takes, I mean, part of the reason we were able to do this is we had that investment of that stimulus money, right, and so we could plan it out. But we've done a rigorous, non-experimentally designed study of family courts that show it to be effective. But we feel like this, we're not big risk takers with the taxpayers' dollars. We like to go right where there's the strongest evidence that this is something that's going to be effective. Adult drug court is probably the most analyzed intervention in the criminal justice system. And so that's where most of our dollars are. But I think there's an opportunity to create more. And so we've done the one family drug court, and I think we should do more. We have to keep working on it. Mm-hmm.
So is there anyone who's done any sort of trial on mental health court?
Yeah, so I was just going to say, I believe other states have done research on these other types of specialty courts.
Well, and I guess that's really what my question is, not necessarily here.
Yeah, so we kind of talked about, you know, the meta-analysis. Mm-hmm. A meta-analysis of drug courts could have, you know, 100-plus studies in it. So for mental health courts, you know, maybe there's only 10 studies to date, but we can still pull those together and kind of pull those all together into kind of a smaller meta-analysis and get an idea of that effect size. Same thing with veterans courts and other types of specialty courts. So I feel like the body of evidence is growing for those as well. It's still in the beginning stages.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hicks.
Thank you. Actually, going back to slide 9 and your final bullet, it's the one-year new charge rates for all participants in the study. How did you keep track of how somebody got a new charge? And even going forward, after they get discharged from drug court or probation, what is your plan to keep track of whether people are being charged again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. So the Criminal Justice Commission is a clearinghouse of criminal justice data. So for this, we use the OGIN database to track if they had a new charge. So we actually get raw data from the Judicial Department of that data. And so through the magic of a statistical software program, we know everybody that was in our drug court. We have their SID number, their name, their date of birth. And then we can merge that with their OGIN data. So we can see all their past history. We can see the charge that looks like that's what brought them into the program, right? They have a ID theft conviction or a motor vehicle theft conviction close to the time that they started the program. And we have the randomization date of when they entered the study. And so then we look forward to see if there's a new charge entered into that database. We also do the same thing with the corrections data. So the 1 year is a little early, but I think at either the 2 or the 3 year mark, we'll look at felony conviction and also returns to prison from that data. We can do that as well.
And Mr. Chair? Well, so, I mean, Multnomah and Jackson are going to E-Court. What do you do now?
Yeah, so we worked with the Judicial Department to get that raw data as well. So it's called Odyssey. So now we have OGIN and we have Odyssey. But the data stored in there is very similar. So we can pull that raw data. We can format all the little special ways to bring it together into one database. So we're able to bring them both together to be able to see that.
Finally. And do you have similarly, are you checking with federal records?
We do not have the federal records, and we do not have the out-of-state records. So that is the limitation of this study, that it's just recidivism just at the Oregon level.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right.
One more item. The Oregon State Bar Reporter Interim Task Force, Travis Prestwich. Gravy.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Travis Prestwich. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors. I'm a member of that board and also serve as a practicing attorney here in Salem. As you know, the Oregon State Bar governs approximately 14,000 lawyers here in Oregon, both in terms of making sure that we adequately serve the public in the interests of justice, but also regulate the practice of law. And the Board of Governors is a 18-member board with 14 elected members who are attorneys and then 4 public members. During the 2013 session, the Senate Judiciary Committee considered 3 specific bills, Senate Bill 798, 799, and 812, which brought forth fairly significant concerns by judges, but didn't have the what was necessary to pass through both chambers. And so Senator Prozanski asked that we, as a bar, form task forces to take a look at these issues. And with your indulgence, I'd like to just briefly review those task forces and the outcomes. Senate Bill 798 is a task force established to address and study the issues of alternate jurors. In the civil system, in a civil case, those rules regarding trials are governed by the Uniform Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. And recently, the body that adopts those rules made a change in which a case in which alternate jurors had been dismissed, if there was a reason that one of the jurors could not continue forward, then both parties could agree to essentially reinstate that alternate juror to have him or her hear and participate in deliberations. And what that does is it allows the parties to go forward to get a decision and have the case be decided. Well, in the criminal scenario, that's not authorized currently. And so this proposal from the task force is that the statute be amended to allow a judge to replace a juror in such cases so long as both parties agree to the substitution. And so that is what has been presented by this particular task force, and that's our recommendation. For Senate Bill 799, it deals with changes or substitutions of attorney. The concern brought forth by judges is that there are times or circumstances in which an attorney will an attempt to substitute out or resign while it's close to trial. It affects the docketing of that case. It can affect the outcome of the case. But there's also the issue of the attorney perhaps not being in a position to be able to go forward. And quite frankly, this task force learned that the rules or the procedures, better said, for this sort of circumstance varies from circuit courts to justice courts to different counties. There's not really a uniform procedure. And so this task force tried to balance all of those issues. And one of the things that they determined is that attorneys are trained to look at the Uniform Trial Court rules, the rules of civil procedure, and therefore they've adopted such a procedure that is more uniform, that will apply to all of the courts in Oregon. That way, all of the attorneys and all of the judges know under what circumstances and what sort of a time frame an attorney can substitute in or out of a case. And then lastly, Senate Bill 812 deals with motions to disqualify judges. Currently, under current Oregon law, an attorney can file 2 separate motions to disqualify a judge in a case if that attorney feels that she can't get a fair trial. And so what happens is they file the initial motion. Typically that's granted because the reasons basically say that it's the attorney's belief that she can't receive a fair trial for her client in that case, and then a new judge would be assigned, almost always granted. Secondarily, a new judge is then appointed, and under the current rule, the attorney could ask for that motion to disqualify the new judge. Where this becomes a problem is in circuits or districts in which there's only a limited number of judges, 1 or 2 judges, and almost always results in that county being required to bring in a judge from another district, and that's a significant expense to the county. Despite that difficulty and the expense, the members of this particular task force were concerned that by changing it or disallowing it, it would create a problem in that we need to make sure that
that the attorneys and the clients, those that are involved in cases, have a feeling and a sense that they're getting a fair trial. And so for the task force itself, they weren't able to come up with a recommendation, but identified several issues for you to look at. And I just want to state that the attorneys on all sides had some nervousness about limiting the ability to remove a judge entirely. It was brought up in our meeting that in Washington, I believe it is, they allow one substitution rather than two. But sometimes change is hard for attorneys, too. So in any event, you have the information before you and can address it at the next session, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions? Representative Hicks.
Full of questions today. I do, though, on an access to justice kind of theme, I'd like to return to Senate Bill 799 regarding motions for change of attorney. In on pages 5 and 6, withdrawal of the attorney on record, it does say in 1B on page 5, when there are 56 or fewer days before the date of any trial or evidentiary hearing, an attorney of record may withdraw from a case only by an order of the court. And so I would suggest, and even in a criminal case as well, that this could happen, right? And say, now, a person is in custody, they're unhappy with their attorney, they decide to retain another attorney, and they want to invoke their 60-day right to a speedy trial. So the attorney could end up getting expenses associated with the case, hire an investigator, whatever the case may be. This is extremely risky then for an attorney to take the case if he's got to get paid 56 days prior to the case. And you could find out that some attorneys are a lot less inclined to take cases if you put a 56-day requirement on it. I'm just throwing that into the discourse.
And Susan Graby with Oregon State Bar, with your permission, I'd like to actually ask Gail Meyer to come up because she was involved in this discussion and can probably address your question better than I can, Representative Hicks.
Thanks.
We have the lifeline.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I was present during the discussions. Representative Hicks, your point with respect to the 60-day rule, can I just say the 60-day rule creates havoc and pure hell for defense counsel in all respects. There's nothing about the 60-day rule that does not inject sheer terror into a defense lawyer. Basically, the 60-day rule says that if a criminal accused is in jail and cannot get out of jail, they have the right to demand a speedy trial within 60 days. And sometimes they demand it. And these can be very serious charges. There might be delays in getting discovery. You don't have that kind of time to get your experts up to speed. But if the client insists on a speedy trial within 60 days, that lawyer has to torque into overdrive. And it is just pure terror. It just is. So that being said, there was the general sense amongst the work group, and one that we really couldn't object to, that there's entitled to be a certain orderliness about who's the point person for the accused in this case, and that there needs to be a certain amount of accountability, that you can't just shift lawyers at the very last minute. And so as the criminal trial approaches sooner and sooner and sooner, at some point a lawyer cannot simply say to the court, I'm done, I'm out of here, go find a new lawyer, because you need to worry about the orderly administration of the court docket itself. So it was a compromise that we did agree to. It is going to hurt in a 60-day situation, but everything hurts in a 60-day situation. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Further questions?
Questions, Chair. So I know the day is late. On the 812, Senate Bill 812, motions for change of judge, my committee members will recall that I had strong feelings about it. I guess I've just been trained by very old school lawyers who never exercise their right. And the fact that in small jurisdictions it clearly allows lawyers to essentially select the judge, it just doesn't feel right to me. I understand that you guys weren't able to reach resolution. I'm happy to move forward with any other committee members next session if it's ripe for that. Having said that, would it be best, it's not urgent, we could go to, should we see if the council court procedures should deal with it, or do you feel this is ripe for us to go ahead and try and reach a legislative solution?
If I might, Chairs. Susan Graby with Oregon State Bar, Chair Przanski-Barker, Representative Barton. That is one we could not resolve. However, we are presenting all three of these reports to this committee, two with recommendations, 812 without a recommendation, because we could not reach an agreement and thought that it was best to leave it to the decision makers to make that choice. I'm not sure that the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure is the appropriate body to deal with this. I think it's probably more a legislative issue. And while our task force did not come up with a report or recommendation, we have a report but not a recommendation, I do believe there are some judges who are looking at whether or not they want to do something with this report. Is that fair enough?
Certainly.
It's very fair.
Sounds like things are ripe, and I'm happy to work with you, Mr. Chair, or anyone else in the committee who would be interested in this issue.
That'd be great. I would like to just say I want to thank the bar for taking on the task that was requested of you. This is one of those situations that is very important for us as legislators, even though some of us do have legal backgrounds, to be able to rely on the association to be able to bring individuals that are, you know, certified smart, as the president of the Senate would say, together and really hash out these issues. And even though you know, it may not be the way we go, but it gives us some direction for us to know exactly how it will impact the practice, to ensure that individuals that are seeking and needing to have counsel, needing to have their opportunity to be represented in the justice system and have their day in court, have the best ability and knowledge of before us as we make policy decisions. So thank you very, very much for all the time and effort. And I know there are many individuals who are around the table who were pulling hair out as they were working through these issues. Yes. So thank you.
And I just would add, as the good senator said, it's important to the lawyers on the committee. It's very important to the non-lawyers on the committee. We really appreciate your efforts.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Well, yeah, Mr. Chair. Okay. Travis, just really quick, how often does this happen? I mean, where the attorneys really struggle with receiving a fair trial from that judge.
Co-chairs, Representative Olson. I wasn't involved specifically in the committee, but as part of our discussion, I think the evidence would indicate that there seem to be a few attorneys. By and large, most attorneys don't use this, but a few attorneys exercise it more often than others, and that's part of the bottleneck, because by and large, I think it functions fairly well.
Co-chairs and Representative Olson. We tried to get some data, and the data out of OGEN is not always great. What it did show was that I think the criminal defense lawyers were much maligned going into this, but we saw a substantial number of these filings in the family law sector, and you saw spikes in certain counties. So in certain counties, there were multiple filings, and in other counties, hardly any at all. And sometimes they would be judicial districts right next to each other, and you might think that these lawyers would practice in both judicial districts. So it's not maybe just the lawyers. Maybe there's something there with a particular court. So the data was difficult to interpret, but it did present a mosaic picture. It doesn't look the same in every judicial district, and it's not only the defense lawyers. I'll just put it out that way.
Well, I like mosaics, too.
Certainly not just defense lawyers.
Mr. Chair, I think we're talking a lot about rural counties, but anecdotally, in districts like mine, some law firms choose to affidavit a certain judge for all of the cases in that law firm. And so it shows up in different ways.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Adjourn the House. During the committee?